Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, episode 3 of Lessons in Chemistry, Living Dead Things is over, but we're just getting started. I'm Dr. Amanda, and I am joined by my esteemed colleague, somebody who I know well and never long enough. It is Dr. Melissa. Melissa, how are you?
Hi, I'm actually going to have the cat do the podcast here that's sitting next to me, if you happen to be watching the video here.
You have a talking cat? Do you want me to hear your cat's inner monologue throughout the duration of this podcast?
I mean, she is very loud, so you might hear her at some point in this podcast. But yeah, I figure she's got it. She'll tell us her thoughts and feelings, and she can let us know what she thought of the episode. Because she was, you know, she's sitting on the couch right next to me as I watched it, so...
Talking pets, animal point of view. We're going to get into it all. But before we get started on all of that today, please do make sure that you are subscribed to the Apple TV Plus Post Show Recaps podcast feed. And you can do that by searching for Post Show Recaps Apple TV wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us out to subscribe, and of course leave us your ratings and reviews if you are so inclined. It helps people find the show. You can also consider becoming a Post-Show Recaps patron, and the patron program is fantastic. You can find Melissa and me in the Discord, get access to the Discord, early access to podcasts, as well as patron exclusive podcasts. Merch is available at higher levels. It's really fantastic, and you can sign up for that at patreon.com/postshowrecaps or postshowrecaps.com/patreon. And if you were in the Discord and you were continuing to have the Lessons in Chemistry conversation with us there, then you might have known that we were in for a talking dog this episode.
Yeah, we didn't know, but the book readers were basically all behind spoiler text going, just wait until they get to the talking dog. And do you know what? I feel like somebody could have given us a heads up. I think I don't know. Maybe
your cat should have told you, Melissa.
Yeah. Nora, why didn't you let me know? What is happening?
Yeah, let's just start off there. This is episode 3 of Lessons in Chemistry, Living Dead Things. I thought that, you know, the plot advances in this episode in, you know, interesting ways. I enjoyed some of the choices they made. They made an extremely strong choice to have this episode told from the dog's point of view. When I saw this, I imagine I was like, this must have been a chapter in the book that was written from the dog's point of view.
Yeah, and it sounds, I think, like, we got that confirmation. Yeah.
Yes. And it sounds like indeed that's what it was. But we straight up get dog point of view narration from the dog named 630. I believe the voice of this dog is BJ Novak from the Office game. Okay. So it's clear that this is what I'm forgetting her name now, the author of the novel. It's clear that this was, you know, her choice in portraying this, that she wrote a, and I'm going to get this, this is Bonnie Garmus, that she wrote a chapter from 630's point of view, which I don't like inherently have a problem with. And I would be really curious to know how it reads in the novel. And like the show makes a choice to be faithful to that artistic choice from the novel, which of course it could have made a departure from that and just not had this one part of the story be portrayed from the dog's point of view. I think that you could, you know, get all of the content here without having it come from the dog's point of view. But then it also makes the choice that, like, of having that first person narration, which I also think that the show could have made a departure from. Like, you could have seen the dog, you could have, like, focused using the camera as featuring the dog's point of view. They could have highlighted the dog at various points in a way that I think, like, could have been an effective choice. We could have started off seeing the dog in that, like, military training, you know, context, and, like, without having the dog narrate. But I was so distracted and annoyed by the fact that I was watching a talking dog in this episode that it really detracted from the episode for me.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with you. I think that I didn't need the sappy, like, cliched commentary of, like, I have failed and I won't do it again. I'm here to protect my family, blah, blah, blah. Like, none of that writing was good enough to justify it coming from the dog. And I agree with you that I think that, like, we could have got an emotional beat. I thought the emotional stuff of, like, the only part of it that I somewhat connected to was when the dog's like, she hasn't been able to look at me. She hasn't touched me mm-hmm. in days. And it was like, gosh, like, that's got to be so hard to, like, look at your dog and associate him with the reason why, like, he was out on the run and, you know, whatever. It's not that it was his fault, certainly by any stretch, but just that it's an association now for her. And so I get that is really hard, but I agree that you could have, like, using camera shots and all of the kind of visual medium that
right.
we often say is, like, really helpful when you get to have an adaptation from a book to a show, all of these things that you can do that you mm-hmm. can't do in a book. And so it's really, yeah, I agree that they could have got the idea of it without actually doing it. And then, yeah, I agree. Like, this is supposed to be some big emotional chapter. And it was in some moments.
Yeah, I think that it ends up being distracting. Like, I agree with you that there is something, like, powerful and compelling about imagining the emotional world of this animal and then imagining the emotional world of Elizabeth, who now, like, sees this animal as a reminder of her loss, right? And, like, how she ends up projecting her feelings of grief and, like, and her own probably feelings of self-blame onto the dog. Like, I can see how that could be interesting and powerful, but because animals don't speak, and because if they did speak, they would not be, like, eloquent writers putting actual words instead of just focusing on that perspective and that emotion, I think ends up cheapening what could have been more powerful. And it does end up being, like, very goofy and cliched. I did a little bit of research on Bonnie Garmus and her decision to include the dog point of view in the novel. She herself has a dog named 99. So obviously there's, like, some connection there between a dog named 630 and a dog named 99. She has an affinity for rescue dogs, and she often takes rescue dogs into her home. So it's, like, it's clear that, like, and that's, like, very, very wonderful and noble. She has a dog named Friday. So she, like, has this penchant for these kind of unusual names for dogs, and that clearly was part of the inspiration here. I don't know. It didn't work for me. It's like, if they made this, if this was, this show, like, has moments I think of comedy, and the way that Brie Larson plays Elizabeth can sometimes be kind of very deadpan funny. And this like felt tonally like mismatched to me. Like I didn't know if there were points where it was supposed to be kind of funny. It was a weird choice. I didn't like it. I hope we're done with it. I thought it was really corny. I was embarrassed for BJ Novak for doing this voice. Like the whole thing was wild. I couldn't believe it. Like I was in disbelief the whole time I was watching this episode. And I needed to get all of that off my chest.
Yeah. I mean, and yeah, if you know, people might not know, I love dogs, big dog person, always had dogs my whole life growing up. It's not the fact that it was a dog or by any stretch, but I agree. It was such a tonal shift from what this show has been. And like, yeah, if you're going to tell an entire story from a dog's perspective, like I'm a big Homeward Bound girly, mm-hmm. like you can absolutely do that. And I'm yeah. down for it. But the fact that most of the rest of this show, as far as we know, is not like this, just makes it such a gimmick that I it felt like it was, as you were saying, detracting from the otherwise like really emotional episode that we were going to yeah. be watching. The other issue I have, just like right off the top, since when are you putting a golden doodle in like military training? Yeah. This is not the breed that you do. And I get that like in the book, I think 630 is supposed to be just like a random mixed rescue mm-hmm. dog. But like that dog is a golden doodle. I don't know what to tell you. And so like, I don't know. It seems a bit wild to me that they were like, oh yeah, I had this like fearful, like the dog could either different breed of dog, or the dog could have had a like fearful upbringing from just like being yeah. a stray dog. Right. Like, I don't know. That felt so much of this felt so over the top that I just,
yeah. Like, yeah. And it felt like emotionally manipulative in a way that it didn't have to be. And like, again, like I think that they could have achieved everything that they wanted to achieve, highlighting the dog's point of view without the voiceover, like do everything mm-hmm. the same without the voiceover, like let us spend the afternoon in the apartment with the dog, all of that, let us see the dog's rescue and all of that, just take away the voiceover and it would have been a lot better. But
yeah. You have an actor like Brie Larson. Like Brie Larson can communicate to you the things that the dog mm-hmm. is saying in her acting, right? She can act distance from this dog. She can act, you know, we can get the dog barking and like we can get it without you needing to give
we
us
can
these,
get
like,
it.
Ultra
yes.
cliche lines. Absolutely. Yes. And like, if we missed a tiny bit of it, I'm okay with missing a cliche bit of it. Like I don't know. It maybe I'm very down for the idea that this works in the book and that the whole idea is potentially like distancing the reader from Zot's emotional experience as she has distanced mm-hmm. herself from her emotional experience. Like I could see that being the reason for this choice, is that like she isn't in touch with her emotions and now we're not even in touch right. with her anymore. We now have a different narrator of this story. Mm-hmm. So okay. If that's the thing though, either the writing has to be better or we do it differently. Like this didn't do that for me. And if that was the intention, this is my most generous read that I can give for this yeah. situation. And book readers, let us know if it worked better in the book, because maybe it does. I'm sort of down for that, but I just don't think Brie Larson needed it. Like I think I got all of that emotion from her without needing this gimmick on top
of it. And like, you know, with adaptations, like, you know, let books do what books can do and let a television show do what a television show can do. And like, because we have visuals, because we have music, because we have these other narrative tools, we don't need everything to be dialogue. We don't need the dog to talk. Period. Exclamation point.
Yeah. We don't need the dog to talk.
We don't need to. But with that, let's get into our sweet 630s origin story, where I was just like, it's narrated from the dog's point of view. I kind of didn't believe it. I kept on thinking it was going to go away and it didn't, but I will get over it. So we can do a recap of this episode. I think I can't promise, but I might get over it. So, you know, we see 630's origin is a military dog. He says, "I was a coward and I hated myself for it." Like, oh my God, come on.
Right.
And eventually 630 escapes under the fence. And this brings us to this scene, which we've already seen from Elizabeth's point of view. And now we're going to see it from 630's point of view, where he's in the trash can and she brings him in. He feels safe. He can protect her. That was his purpose.
Yeah. I mean, again, I would have loved seeing this, you know, kind of the lead up to this episode or to this moment from the dog's point of view. Maybe the dog's like wandering, kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, gets chased away from some yards or something and then like ends up at, you know, her house. Like I could see that being a really lovely moment. I didn't mm-hmm. need it said out loud. Like, I understand. I understand analogy. I understand yeah. metaphor. Like,
it's very children's programming. Yeah. It's like, it's very children's programming. Everything that the dog says here. But then, you know, we go from that to the scene again that we've seen where Evans is going to get hit by the bus on the run. And, you know, in that moment, everything 630 had ever thought about himself, every worst fear came true. And then we go to the opening credits. Finally, we go
again,
to
the tonal shift to the opening credits. Shift. Like, it's so wild. Also, like, I think I wrote this in high school, Amanda. Like, I think I think I have this in like a creative writing poetry assignment mm-hmm. of like, you know, every worst thing I've ever thought about myself came true the day that I let down this person that I love. Like,
yeah,
I have to believe that the writers on this show and the writer of this book are better than this. I'm not even like a very critical person when yeah. it comes to writing. I don't know.
It does make anyway. me want to see this chapter in the book. And like, I'll go back now that I've seen through here and look at all of the spoiler tag conversation in the Discord to see what's already been said about this. But it does like make me really curious about how effective this is in the book. Because like the actual dialogue, the actual narration that's given to the dog, like is very simple and trite, which is like, okay, because I think that like dogs have, you know, I mean, no offense, like no insult to dogs. Like they're
again, pro dog podcast,
like they're wonderful, but it's like, they do have like goldfish brains and they wouldn't narrate something the way a human would. Like it would be much more emotional and impressionistic and like not linguistically sophisticated because they're dogs. But I would be curious to see how this plays in the book. If it does come off, I think like a little bit more consistent with the tone of the rest of the story. In Elizabeth's
I just want
house
dogs to have better yeah. self-esteem. Sorry, I keep like not letting you move on from this scene. But
no,
like,
that's okay. We can just stay here the whole time, Melissa.
I just like don't think that dogs are this down on themselves, right? I think most dogs think that they're like pretty good pups. They're pretty good boys.
Right. I mean, to talk about like sense of self from a dog's point of view, I think it would be pretty different from like a human sense of self because of like mm-hmm. different long-term memory capacity and autobiographical memory. I don't know. Like, I don't think they would be like, this reminds me of when I was in the military and I feel like I just wouldn't be like that. Yeah. But this is what 630 is thinking. This is what, and I know that because he tells me it in his human voice.
Sorry, you can go on now.
We're moving on. we see Elizabeth like in the immediate aftermath. Like, again, like this is, and I think that this is all really effective because we're getting this still from 630's point of view, but we're seeing Elizabeth kind of stunned and speechless with the police coming and telling her what happened. We see her go through the process of selecting a coffin, planning the funeral arrangements. We see her ignoring the phone. So all of this, I think, really works because it's like visual storytelling where we're seeing Elizabeth and she's very kind of disconnected from everything, sort of depersonalized. And you know, because 630 is always with her, we're seeing it from his point of view.
It was all great because there was no talking dog.
We also see like Harriet with her family at church, the, with the kids asking where Dr. Evans is now. You know, they talk about his body and his soul. Harriet says that his soul is in heaven. And we see how much that this is also like weighing really heavily on Harriet because she sort of steps away and goes outside to cry after being strong for her children. Interestingly, the dog was not in church, so I don't know how we even see this because we're hearing this from the dog's point of view.
No
dogs in church. No. We go to the funeral and we see the burial. Elizabeth is there with 630. She is in the front two rows that are reserved for family, but she's alone. And we know already from Calvin himself that he doesn't have any living family. Harriet is also there attending the funeral, but she's sitting far in the back. A reporter approaches Elizabeth and says that he's writing a story about Calvin. He asks her if she knew him well. She says, "I didn't know him long. I didn't know him long enough." We find out that the reports that he's getting so far are not painting a very flattering picture. Somebody said he had his moments. Somebody else said he was a real jerk. You know, this like reporter is just like extremely rude and like very inappropriate. He tells her she shouldn't have dogs. He's not being very like delicate given the situation that he's in.
The audacity of this man at a funeral to approach the person sitting in the front row. Like, first of all, nobody else sitting there, even if she's not family, like who's she hurting by sitting in the front row of this thing? Fine. And then, the whole like, hey, you want to give me the scoop on this guy? Because, you know, other people say he's a real jerk as you're sitting here clearly mourning him.
Yeah.
And like, also get your dog out of this like open outdoor space that.
Right.
This man.
No.
He gets no credit for the stuff he does later on in the episode because this is too much.
This is too much. I guess that he does have a little bit of a redemption in this episode, but not off to a great start. We get more of, you know, Elizabeth's going to get up and leave eventually. She's unable to stay there for the duration of the funeral. We get more of 630's point of view. He wants a walk. She didn't speak to him for days. She didn't touch him. She barely looks at him. 630 feels like the death of Calvin is his fault. And over time, she's not going to, she was hoping that she would forget about it, but she doesn't. This is Elizabeth's state. She does want to come back to work and she's eager to get back to work. She goes to the Hastings lab and the secretaries are gossiping. They can't believe she's here. The body's still warm. You hear their gossip. She goes to the lab really eager to pick up her work where she left off and it's been completely cleaned out. She wants to know where Calvin's things are. We learn that everything went down to storage and all of that work belongs to Hastings. Melissa, in terms of intellectual property and working for a place like Hastings or working for a university, I know that in industry, like you do pretty much sign away your intellectual property to your employer. is so I was just wanted to us to speak to a little bit to whether this is unusual or whether this is something that would be pretty standard.
Yeah, I think this gets back to this whole kind of question we had about what Hastings is, if it's like a research institution as part of a college, or if it's somehow like a privately funded research lab that is still somehow applying for this grant, which isn't like incredibly unheard of. So that is sort of my guess here. And so in this case, yeah, the idea that Hastings now like is ownership of that, because even I had it in academia, certainly as when I was working in like other people's labs, right? I was never the PI myself. The idea was like, yeah, you leave your lab notebooks behind when you finish your time in the lab so that, you know, people can continue on that work and whatever, and that work continues to be a part of that lab rather than something that you take home forever. So that part didn't like surprise me too much, but I don't know if you had different thoughts there.
Yeah, no, I think that this would be like completely expected if you're working for any kind of industry that you don't like. And I remember like there were places that I worked more in like research and development. I worked for, you know, I think it was Telcordia Technologies. It was formerly Bell Labs, and I think it became something else. But when I start, I did that like a high school and college internships there. And on the first day, they buy your intellectual property for a dollar. Like everybody gets a dollar, like a literal, like single dollar paper money, and you sign something, and then they own anything that you do, that you create while you're there. Dr. Evan.
In Canada, we call that loony for your thoughts.
A loony for your thoughts. That's so much more fun than what it felt like.
This episode is made possible by PwC. A robot may not be coming for your job, but competitors are coming for your market share. At PwC, we pair the right tech with the right solutions to help you gain a competitive edge. Reimagine operations from the cloud. Fuel innovation with responsible AI and detect risks before they become headlines. That's human-led and tech-powered. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at thenewequation.com.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Doc, I don't know if like Dr. Evans, if Calvin as PI, like if he transferred institutions, I imagine he would have been able to take his work with him, I think, you know, like at least in academia, you often can do that. But Elizabeth, like as a lab technician, technically, it makes sense that she would not have any ownership over that work, which is part of like what was so important about, you know, those conversations she was having with Calvin about like, you know, with if I don't stand on my two feet, I don't have anything. And it's like very true that like, and I think that this was such a powerful episode, talking dog notwithstanding, because we had speculated about just how beholden Elizabeth was to Calvin's like belief in her and his goodwill, and that that was not something that had any currency or would be recognized outside of his love for her, and that like we see when she loses him all of a sudden how her status falls and how little leverage she actually has, even though it is her intellectual work and it is something that she contributed to.
Yeah, absolutely. It was not at all the way I thought she was going to lose access to all of that. I had certainly more cynical thoughts around Calvin and what he might do. But yeah, dying was not what I expected him to do.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think it's, it all tracks for me that she has lost access to this and that Hastings is going to try to continue on. But I did find it quite funny that they're like clearly trying to do it without her. And
yeah,
you know, clearly that's not going to go over quite so well because they seem fairly incompetent.
Yeah. Yeah. So she, you know, is like the lab is gone. She can't get back in it. She can't get access to the work. She asks Fran if there's any empty lab space she can use. She can't get at, like, she can't have his personal items, his records, all of that. They have to keep those things in case there's a living relative who comes for them. Fran does take some pity on Elizabeth here, and she says that she's going to, like, find her some work to continue at Hastings, but she can't bring the dog. So, again, another great injury to 630, who's going to have to stay home alone, watching cartoons and eating kibble from a Rube Goldberg contraption.
Yeah, this was quite clever. I like the whole automatic timer thing. I have certainly considered such things for cats.
Yeah, I think you can't you buy like time release food dispensers?
Yeah, you can just buy this now. You don't have to jerry rig it yourself. Yeah.
You know, at Hastings, Elizabeth does get a job and she's taking like, it looks like her job is like taking dictation from like a senile, doddering old man who somehow still has like emeritus status here at Hastings Lab, but really just spends his time like dictating complaints to the crossword editor of newspapers.
Yeah, I honestly, this is what happens, I think, when you give tenured professors, you know, the longest of leashes and don't, you know, make them retire.
Please let it be me. I'm ready. I'm ready for that era.
Yeah.
Just give me somebody that I can sit across from and like reminisce about different cafeteria offerings. I'm so there. At the Hastings Lab, I think that, who is this actor? I got to look this up. The guy who plays like the director or the chairman of the board.
Weasley guy.
Yeah, no, it's actually not. It's not the chairman of the board. I'm going to get the IMDb up so I can figure out who this is. It is Beau Bridges, of course. Beau Bridges, who was like lurking behind in the funeral, is now showing up to talk to Donati about how Hastings is going to lose the Remsen funding. Because now that they no longer have Evans and his brilliance, you know, then, you know, they won't be able to continue to receive this research funding. But Donati tells him that Evans was actually a good friend of his and a lab mate, and they had been working together on the project that they were going to apply for the funding for, and he would like to continue that work. So this is like a clear misrepresentation. Obviously, Donati is just trying to trick this benefactor into, you know, that like he's actually going to be able to carry out this groundbreaking work. And all of a sudden, it does become important to Donati that the work that Zott and Evans had started is going to be continued. So, he reaches out to another young chemist, and I finally got his name down later in the episode somewhere. I'm not finding it right now, but this is somebody who was sort of friendly with
Alfred. You've got
Alfred.
It later,
yeah. That's his name. Alfred. Thank you. So Alfred is going to be enlisted by Donati to sort of continue on with this work. Of course, they don't even think of involving Elizabeth, who obviously knows exactly what's going on and would be the natural person to continue on because Donati is a cartoon villain, Melissa.
Yeah. Well, I thought it was very funny that like earlier he gets told off basically like, you're a middleman, you're replaceable. Mm-hmm. Like we need the chemist. We don't actually need you. Anyone could do your job. And so his response is like, okay, I'm going to do chemistry then. And it's, but yeah. And of course, yeah, there's, you know, we're going to see it later on in the episode as well. There's like zero good to this guy. And so, yeah, he doesn't clearly have any consideration for Elizabeth or her capabilities at all. And I think I think it's probably because he's not a chemist, right? Like, I think some of the other chemists at least.
I thought he was a chemist. Like, I imagined that he was, like, because they call him Dr. Donati, so he has his PhD. I imagined that he was, like, somebody, and this is, like, how academia works, is, like, you know, people get, like, move up through administrative roles, like, right? Like, you can become the chair of somebody from the department becomes the chair of the department, and then the chair of the department over time becomes like a provost, or provost becomes a dean, or a dean becomes a president. Like, these things happen, and like, you know, I've seen people's academic careers go this way. And as you take on administrative responsibilities, you have less and less time to do your science. Some people who are really brilliant scientists will become promoted through administration. Not everybody is. Like, Donati is clearly like a mediocre scientist. Like, it seems like a lot of the scientists at Hastings are really, like, when Elizabeth was in that other lab under Dr. Price, like, you know, people weren't very impressive. It seemed like Evans was really a unique shining star. But I imagine that Donati is a chemist, like, not a very distinguished one, but who somehow managed to do well enough that he started to move up through the administrative ranks and has, you know, kind of geared his career towards that.
Totally. Yeah. And yeah, you're probably right. I think I was just thinking in terms of the, like, having worked in the lab with Elizabeth, at least the other chemists have seen her, like, answer their questions and know how to do all of this. So they've at least, she has, I think, sort of worn them down to have a tiny bit of respect for her, like, chemistry know-how at the very least, even if they don't respect her as a person or, you know, worthy of any sort of autonomy or career advancement or any of the things that we, you know, might allow women to have at some point. But for now, at least, he's not even going to do any of that. And, you know, he's going to turn to Brace's face instead. And
yeah,
tries to figure this out, even though he clearly also, I think, chose this guy not because he was a great chemist, but because he could boss him around and that he would probably give in to what he wanted.
Right. And Donati is, like, particularly blind to Elizabeth's merit because he's also, like, just repulsively sexist. And Alfred, at least, is, like, going to say, well, shouldn't you ask Zot to do it? Like, it is her work. And Donati basically threatens him, if you're not up for the task, I'll find someone else. So they're going to embark on trying to replicate this work. In the meantime, we see that Elizabeth is back at home and has baked a pie. She initially sets the table for two, which is, like, very sad. Then she clears away the setting for Calvin, and sort of after kind of, like, meticulously making this very nice table setting, she kind of sloppily just scoops up a spoonful of pie, but tastes it and immediately runs to the sink to spit it out. Then we see her wake up in the night sick to her stomach. I immediately knew that this was, like, television, like, speak for she's pregnant. But we see it always that she takes, you know, the only reason that women ever throw up is because they're pregnant.
It's also the only way they ever find out they're pregnant is because nobody bothers to, nobody as meticulous as Zot ever, you know, keeps track. You know,
well, we see her, we see her, like, log of her menstrual cycle, and we realize that she had just written, like, that she missed her January period or something. And then, like, it's like, of course she would have already known. She wouldn't have needed to do this. But anyway, so Elizabeth is pregnant, and or she thinks she might be pregnant. So we see that she, like, looks up in this periodical determining pregnancy status. And then we go to the series of scenes where she comes into a lab that's filled with frogs. She, she threw some kind of white lie, ends up obtaining a couple of frogs. We see she takes them, has them in separate tanks, one that says experimental, one that says control. And I looked this up, Melissa. Mm-hmm. This frog test is a pregnancy testing method relying on two frogs to determine pregnancy status, provided that immunological pregnancy tests were not yet developed before the 1960s. So at this time, there would not have been the drugstore pregnancy test available to Elizabeth, but women could use different animals for urine-based pregnancy tests, ranging from frogs to mice. And what they would do is what she does is she like injects urine into one of the frogs and not the other frog. Like I'm trying to see the the Hodgepin test procedure consisted of injecting a sample of women's urine into the skin on the back of a frog, specifically into the dorsal lymph sac. Around 12 hours later, results could be seen. If the woman was pregnant, then the frog would be ovulating and a small cluster of eggs could be seen at the rear end of the frog. Interestingly, the same could be observed in the male species. Okay, blah, blah, blah. This mechanism is due to the pituitary hormone, human chorionic gonadotropin, which is present only in a pregnant woman's urine. If the woman is not pregnant, no sperm or egg would be produced from the male or female frog, respectively. So, yeah, Elizabeth does this frog pregnancy test.
So you're telling me this isn't how you found out you were pregnant with your kids, Amanda? How every scientist finds out.
I used mice. I didn't use frogs.
There was so much about this that I love. First of all, like having worked, my undergrad labs were sort of, I got the sense of the same kind of thing where it's like, physics labs and then down the hallway are the chemistry labs and then just down the hallway are the biology labs. Mm-hmm. And I remember at one point working in the biology lab when like alarms were going off down the hallway and I was like looking around at the grad students I was working with being like, should we leave? Like, what? And they're like, oh no, it's like chemistry down the hall. It's fine. We don't have to. And I was like, isn't that worse if there's alarms going off in the chemistry labs? Like that seems, if there's alarms going off in the biology labs, like maybe not so bad, but like in the chemistry lab, I think you want to get out of there. So I love this that she just like popped over to biology, picked up a couple frogs and like did this experiment. And the frog guy being like, nobody tells me anything. I'm just here hanging with frogs.
I just sit down here in the basement with the frogs.
Yeah, that felt so accurate to like the bio guy. His job is to like study frogs. And so he doesn't get the same clout that everybody else gets. So they just leave him alone and then, come when they need something. I thought it was very funny.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this was very neat. This was a very fun this was like a very fun little like window into like, first of all, it's like very fitting with Elizabeth's character of like, her being like the methodical scientist who's going to, instead of going to a doctor or waiting another month to see what happens, like she's going to go and do this test. And also like it was really neat to get this window into the world of like the 1950s when you didn't have drugstore pregnancy tests available and all of that at your disposal and just how like resourceful she is. So that was cool. And then we get after the pregnancy test, the timer that she uses to determine like the period of time where she checks the result and the frogs is a stopwatch that has like a broken face. And I thought this must be Evans's stopwatch from the, from the accident. When the watch goes off and she gets a result, the dog says, I knew the baby was coming before she did. Okay. But her reaction, I thought, like, was really powerful. She takes a sledgehammer and she like breaks the watch first. Does she break the watch or does she just break? She breaks the watch. And then we see that she starts taking the sledgehammer to completely obliterating the countertop. Harriet comes to the door and is like, concerned about what is going on with the sound she hears. And she tells Harriet, I'm building an industrial grade chemical lab. This exchange, I thought, like, I really like these two characters together. Yeah. And I think I'm glad that, like, I think we're going to get to see them develop a relationship around the loss of Calvin, at least initially. And Harriet is coming to tell her about this LA Times article and just how, you know, horribly it portrays Calvin. And she wants to go and fix it. She wants to file an affidavit. Elizabeth at this point doesn't even like know who she is, who Harriet is. They introduce one another. They introduce themselves to each other. And Elizabeth just says, I'm sorry, I'm not myself lately.
Yeah, there was a part of me that was nervous that like these two got so like googly at each other that like, Calvin didn't even mention like, oh yeah, this is my neighbor who I like, whose kids I take care of sometimes. And,
right.
Like, these people in my life. Like, I was like, did you, I don't know. I wanted her to any sort of acknowledgement that she'd like ever heard Harriet's name mentioned right. before, but I get it. She's not herself. So it's fine. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's also like, yeah. I mean, so it is like, it made me wonder, you know, also just how long their courtship was, even though like, mm-hmm. it's clear that they got very close. Like the fact that she doesn't know Harriet at all. She had just sort of, I guess, recently moved in. I think it also sort of speaks to how like they were in this honeymoon phase where they were so involved with each other that mm-hmm. they were like a little bit oblivious to the rest of the world. But there is something sad, I think, both about like there is something sad, especially given that like Calvin did let Harriet down, that like he wouldn't have shared that he had this other important relationship in his life, mm-hmm. like that they wouldn't be aware of each other. But like, it's clear that like they are going to, you know, be able to eventually bond over it. Elizabeth's also strange and not particularly social. So I think that it can kind of make sense, but yeah, it would have been like nice. It would have been nice for him to like honor both of these women in his life more by like acknowledging their existence to other people. Yeah. But I mean, I guess he's the guy that like nobody comes to his funeral and the people who do say mean things about him. So maybe you can chalk it up to that. So Harriet does go to the LA Times and she goes and complains about the Evans piece. What you wrote was inaccurate. It was libel and it was wrong. The man was and she reads some like sections. The man was as brilliant as he was boring. But she says that he was the warmest person she knew. If his mind was great, his heart was greater. And, you know, he's obviously not going to change the article. Controversy spices up papers, but he says, you know, if you have any other good stories, like, let me know. And this, you know, makes a light bulb go off in Harriet's head.
Yeah, this guy sucks. And if I was Harriet, I don't know, like, obviously beggars can't be choosers. Harriet's just looking for help with this, mm-hmm. getting some media attention on it. She figures, hey, you want controversy? I've got some controversy for you. But I wouldn't trust this man to like tell her story well either. Right. Like, right. I would be really nervous and am nervous about how he will talk about this event as it unfolds and who he will need to kind of acquiesce to in order to keep his job and like what he's willing to do, yeah. how far he's willing to stick his neck out to write this story in a fair way to Harriet. Like, I wouldn't bet on that. And we sort of get the story at the end seeming like, you know, he did do that and did talk about her doing well at the meeting. But if we see this man again, like, I'm just waiting for the other shoe to drop, I think, here.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I hadn't initially thought about this, but I'm going to give you credit for pointing this out, because like, I do think what we see in the story so far is how vulnerable women are and how relying, how they need to rely on men in this world to get their voices heard, to like have the impact that they want to have. But in that reliance, they are extremely, you know, vulnerable, and they can be, you know, just as easily sold out. So I would not be surprised. I mean, and it will be very disappointing if it goes here, though, if that's what we see from Harriet's storyline, that like whenever this reporter like doesn't find her to be useful to him anymore, he ends up selling her out, and it's not a good outcome for her. And maybe, you know, we'll see like Elizabeth and Harriet be the ones that kind of come together and help each other out. But I think that's a really good prediction on your part. At the Hastings lab, we see Alfred and Donati trying to work out what Elizabeth and Calvin had been doing, trying to replicate their work and trying to move forward. And I'm going to here highlight a message that I got from the official Lessons in Chemistry correspondent, the great Bill the Chemist, at Bill the Chemist on Twitter. He's on the job market right now. And he said that it's actually more of a knock on Zot and Evans for keeping bad lab notebooks, which isn't actually likely, because we see that Zot is incredibly methodical and likely would have had an incredibly detailed and organized lab notebook. So he was saying that it just doesn't make sense that if you or that like if you really did your experiments and did your science and documented responsibly, then even these two bozos should have been able to follow the lab notebook and replicate the experiments.
Yeah, I was just looking. The cupboard above my desk is where I have stacks of lab notebooks from my like, years in chemistry lab, or not in chemistry labs, in other labs, some of which I, you know, like I said, I had to leave behind in the labs that I was in. But yeah, it is true that like the whole idea of a chemistry or a lab notebook in general is that you should be able to hand that to somebody else and they could completely replicate your work, right? Replication being a really key part of science, right? One person finding one thing one time is not science. People being able to replicate it, you being able to replicate it later on. There's a big kind of issue with this sometimes in psychology research.
Yes.
In particular, around people struggling to replicate the work of other people. And
it turns out that a lot of the biggest, most important, most fundamental experiments in all of psychology have been not been replicated. They call it this replication crisis. I was just reading about it. I was reading about the famous Baumeister experiments about willpower, that there's like, you know, there's so many of these really foundational psychology experiments that have failed to replicate. But that's there's been a lot of discussion about that and what are some of the different factors that cause that. It's really, really very interesting. But at least in basic science, right, like there is a higher, and part of this is, you know, we don't tend to explicate our methods as precisely as some of the basic sciences do. And also there's ways that we don't ever have as much control over things because of individual differences between people and between settings and all of these unobserved confounders that influence human behavior in ways that, you know, we have a better idea of what confounders and what things to control for in basic science than we do in psychological science, where like little things like the color of the room or the temperature or a person's whole of their experiences before they even entered your lab can all influence the results of your experiment. But anyway, all of that's to say that replication is really one of the foundations of science, because it's not a finding if you can't replicate it.
Yeah, I mean, I ranted about this on the Sweet Tooth podcast already. Oh. If anybody happened to have listened to that, because again, they were trying to do some science and they did it one time and they were all bragging about it. And then sure enough, couldn't replicate it. And it was a problem. And I called it because I was like, you don't just do it one time and assume that it's right, because false positives can happen. False negatives can happen. You gotta replicate your work. So yeah, I agree with Bill's notes that, like, it's a bit unbelievable to me that Zot wouldn't take such detailed notes that somebody couldn't replicate it. I'm sort of assuming that this is a bit of an indictment on these two trying to replicate it, that they don't really understand what was going on. And so someone who maybe understood the material could look at this and easily replicate it. And they just, you know, are missing some of the basic knowledge that is required to understand what's happening here.
Yeah, these guys are big, dumb dummies. And I think that that's what the show is trying to get across. And I'm here for that because I'm mad at them. Yeah. Speaking of
being jerks.
Yeah, speaking of big, dumb dummies being jerks, Harriet goes back to city council to lobby about the freeway again. And she has another one of her, like, really great rousing speeches. She asks, like, do you adhere to the U.S. Constitution? Great, because I adhere to the U.S. Constitution, too. And then she mentions the 14th Amendment, which guarantees all people equal protection under the law. Again, she looks behind her to see if the person she invited is going to show up. And this time the LA Times reporter does show up. Unlike Calvin, she's very pleased, and he's going to cover the hearing and publish about it. So that's good news. Temporary win for Harriet. In the meantime, you know, Elizabeth has been working on refitting the kitchen into a lab. There's a lot of great, like, montages of her, like, pounding pork chops and, like, demolishing countertops and doing all of this crazy work. She's, like, extremely intense and focused. And again, this is from the point of view of a dog for some reason.
Yeah. She's doing the rowing thing too.
She's training and rowing. And she's got this, like, absolute ferocity to her, which is bordering on terrifying. Alfred comes to the door, and he's there to bring Calvin's personal items to Elizabeth, but he lies and tells her that the research wasn't there. You know, it might have been misplaced or something. But we know that he's actually using it with Donati to try to kind of usurp the work from Elizabeth. After he leaves, she opens the box and she finds the tennis ball that Calvin used to throw to 6:30. And she also sees that there is a note for Harriet on one of the records, an apology for missing the hearing. So she brings the note over to Harriet's house. Harriet invites her in. They listen to jazz records again. They talk about their memories of Calvin. It's, like, very sweet. We find out that Harriet and Calvin bonded over their love of jazz. They both do impressions of what a bad dancer he is. It's, like, a rare moment of, like, Elizabeth actually, like, seeming to let down her, like, rough exterior and actually enjoy herself a little bit. Harriet eventually asks her, why are you building an industrial grade lab? And she says she needs to finish her research. She's a ticking time bomb, which Harriet instantly understands to mean that she's pregnant. Elizabeth breaks down and says that she doesn't think that she can do it, to which Harriet says, no one can do it, but then you expand. You think you can't do it, but you do it anyway. That's being a mother. This, like, might sound a little bit like Hallmark card-y, but I did find this sort of touching and something that feels really true. And it's not just true of, like, becoming a parent, which really is something that is, like, it's unfathomable. Like, if you, like, it's I remember, like, you know, not being able to imagine, like, what it would be like to have a kid and seeming like I couldn't have possibly done the things that I ended up doing to like keep a kid alive. And then when I had my second, like being like, I can't imagine doing this with two. And then, you know, and it there is like this way that you kind of rise to the occasion and expand. And I think that that's true of like lots of big endeavors. It's true of like running a marathon or finishing a graduate program or like lots of the, you know, making a big move, like lots of things. But I thought that there was like something very sweet about this advice from Harriet to Elizabeth. And I also thought that it felt like very poignant.
Yeah, I really liked it too. I really, you know what? The dog's not in the scene. So I really liked it. But I thought that they're connecting over this moment of like them kind of having this bit of a laugh, but clearly bonding over this shared grief that they have as well, I thought was very lovely. And I thought this like description of motherhood and this moment of Harriet being like the only person that Elizabeth can really talk to about this was really lovely. And especially because when she talks about this expansion, the other thing that it made me talk of was the way people talk about grief and the idea that like over time, grief doesn't get smaller. You just grow around it is kind of how I think it's been put a lot of the time. And so she's sort of expanding in multiple ways right now. And that is, that's going on for her in both this, in both her like literal expansion, but also her capacity to take on motherhood and handle this grief that she's experiencing.
And that's where we get like, after that, we get that montage that we mentioned of the rowing, the working in the lab, the cooking, like day after day, we see the time passing. And we see that, like, you know, her belly is starting to grow. Like, we see that the pregnancy is advancing. We get to see her at work where she's bent over the bathroom sink in the Hastings lab, and Fran walks in noticing that her skirt has been like fastened with a safety pin because she can no longer close it. So we get this sense like this is the show telling us that people are starting to notice that she's pregnant. She goes to the OBGYN and is examined by the doctor here. And he seems to know Calvin. He apologizes to Elizabeth for her loss. He and Calvin rode together. She says that she's been erging. I guess that's like the stationary rower. I didn't know that term.
Yeah, neither did I. I just assumed it was sort of related to ergonomics in some way, but I didn't know. I just know this is like a rowing machine, but I assume.
Yeah.
I assume it's real. We just don't know.
Right, right. So that's, you know, and I thought he was going to like give her this real like old school advice that she like basically needs to be like bedridden until she has a baby. But like, thankfully he didn't do that. And he seemed to be supportive. This actor, I'm looking him up now. I know him as like, he's in a lot of things. I know him as Sean from The Good Place, where he's like,
yeah,
very
that's what I was
funny.
Thinking too. Yeah.
What is this actor's name? This is like a somewhat big cast. So, this is Mark Evan Jackson, I think. Yes, that's right. So he asks why she waited until her third trimester to come in to see the doctor. And she shares that she was hoping that it would just take care of itself, you know, clearly like still feeling very ambivalent about the pregnancy and about the idea of becoming a mother. And then he asks her if she has anyone to rely on, like a family member, her mother. And she says that she has a dog and a neighbor that she sort of knows. And he says, oh, okay. He's like, well, that's great. You've got a dog and a neighbor you sort of know. So you're all set. But he encourages her to like, to, you know, after things have settled down, after she has the baby, to come and row with him in 1 year. He even writes her a prescription boathouse 1 year. So this is definitely like a seed that's being planted that, you know, she's developed this rowing, like she's developed this rowing hobby. And, you know, he seems to know that this is like important for her. And he encourages her to come to the boathouse and row with him once she's ready for it.
Yeah, this was sweet and all, but I wanted him to do like anything helpful for her. Like, I don't know. He's like, hey, do you have anybody? And she's like, no. And he's like, okay, well, you know, in a year from now when you won't be busy or anything, you know, you definitely won't have like a infant still by yourself.
Right.
You know, come hang out. Let's have a good time. Like, what? What are you doing, sir? He is the least problematic.
Right.
I was happy at all the things he didn't do. But boy,
the
did
bar
he also
is in
nothing.
The bar is in hell. The bar is in hell. Yes, he is least problematic man in this episode. So congratulations, congratulations, Doctor. What's his character's name? Dr. Leland Mason. Great job. I liked that he was like kind of non-judgmental though, and for sure. Like it also felt like he sort of acknowledged that like she wasn't going to accept very much, but maybe this was something that she might accept. I don't know. Maybe I'm giving him more credit. But anyway, this is like the extent of her prenatal care. And so this is what we see here in her third trimester. Back at work, though, we have people being the most problematic because Elizabeth is getting fired as... Donati says, because you are with child. She asks her current boss, the old guy, Mr. Astor, if her correspondence has slowed, and it hasn't. She makes a lot, I thought, of like really kind of funny comments here. She says that she's not contagious. Like other people would catch pregnancy from her. And Donati gets offended. He says, are you explaining pregnancy to me? Who do you think you are? And Elizabeth says, a woman, which I really loved.
Protection against protection for pregnancy only became legal in the U.S. in 1978. So like it was perfectly legal to fire someone for being pregnant.
It's really wild. Like Donati says, you know, you're the woman, you're the one who got knocked up when asked if like they would fire a man for impregnating somebody. She says there's no rules for this. And she read the employee handbook from cover to cover. And I believe that she did. Like, I loved how fiercely she stands up for herself here. And it's like, you know, we see her facing unfair retribution for being sexually assaulted. Last episode, we see her like standing up for herself, facing unfair retribution for being pregnant. Donati, in a really like disgusting turn, tells her that Evans would be ashamed of her. And she says, like, no, he would not. So good. And we know that he wouldn't be ashamed of her. Yeah, so this is like she's getting fired. I don't think we know if she's going to win this one yet. But this is where we leave that she's in this precarious position at work. In the neighborhood, Elizabeth and Harriet meet in the street. They were both going over to each other's houses. Elizabeth was going to borrow an axe because the hammer is limiting. While Harriet was coming over to share the article about the city council hearing. And Harriet feels like Calvin helped this happen because of the circumstances that brought her to the LA Times. Elizabeth doesn't understand, you know, what Harriet's driving at. Harriet says she felt him in the room. These are clearly like two very different women who are approaching their grief in very different ways, who are, you know, who deal with like, it's neat because they're both facing adversity and they're both facing the injustices of a system and having to sort of be their own advocates in the absence of anyone else. And they're doing it differently. And I think it's going to be really beautiful to see them rely more on each other because they both have had to do a lot of this alone. And, you know, Harriet tells Elizabeth eventually, whatever you're trying not to feel, you're going to have to let yourself feel it at some point. And that brings Elizabeth back to the box of Calvin's things. And she goes through it. She sees chicken recipes, which is really sweet. He sees a note he wrote apologizing to her. She smells his lab coat. And in the pocket of the lab coat, of course, she finds a wedding ring or engagement ring or whatever it is. But and that's when 6:30 gets up and goes to her. And they have like the first moment, I think, where she sort of acknowledges 6:30, the dog, who's the narrator of this episode, for a really important reason. And then she takes him and they go and takes him for a walk. Like they go on a night walk. And again, it's like I kept on thinking maybe we were done with the dog narrating, but 6:30 says, what can you say to someone who's lost everything? That's the beauty of running. When you can't move forward, your purpose is just being there, putting one foot in front of the other. We see Elizabeth break into a jog, one foot, and then sure enough, you'll be home, says the dog. And it ends with Elizabeth doing the thing that she never thought she would do, which is go jogging for exercise.
I mean, the woman is very into cardio. We're getting that message loud and clear. Mm-hmm. I like, even if you needed this bit at the end of this, like you needed to, you know, spell it out for us and
the one I would get it. I would get it.
I would get it. Yeah. But again, sometimes
you and I, Melissa, we are exceptionally smart people, though. We just
I believe our listeners also would get it. But I'm going to say, like, okay, occasionally I watch TV and I complain about not having my hand held enough through television. Sometimes I like to have it spelled out. Fine. Do you know who else?
Or your paw held? Do you want your paw held?
Oh, man. But you know who could have done this voiceover? Calvin. It could have been Calvin's voice. We didn't need the dog. We could have got him. The dog is quoting Calvin. It could have just been Calvin's voice. It would have been fine. It would have been exactly the same.
I don't like it. I don't like it. It was a bad choice. It was a bad choice. I don't like it. I think it was otherwise a good episode. I think it could have been a great episode.
Yeah, but it was not a great episode.
They gave us something to talk about. I have a few other notes from official Lessons in chemistry correspondent Bill the Chemist. I love how many times I get to say chemistry when I say that. When the two science villains, who I think are, I think that's how he's referring to Donati and Alfred. And I don't think Alfred is a science villain. Maybe he's a science, like, accomplice. He's okay. But when they say, let's start here, they're pointing to what's known as a Strecker synthesis. This is totally legit to what Zotten and Evans were doing, as it's a way to make amino acids from carbonyls, amines, and cyanide. This is a very popular reaction to this day because it allows chemists to synthesize unnatural amino acids, and there have been many advances in making this reaction asymmetric. Obviously, making amino acids would be right in line with the origin of life research they were conducting.
Cool.
That's cool. And then Bill also wanted me to give some flowers to Eric Jacobson with regard to Strecker synthesis, because Jacobson developed an organocatalytic variant in the 90s, and he developed a lot of asymmetric variants of the Strecker synthesis using chiral shift bases, I believe. So shout out to Eric Jacobson. Who is not a woman, though, Melissa.
No, not a woman. But I do, chiral is definitely a word that I used to know what it meant. So cool. This sounds like real chemistry.
That's what we go to Bill for, real chemistry. So do we have a woman in science for this week, Melissa?
We do. First of all, it was kind of important to us to make
sure. Do we have a dog in science? Do we have any dogs in science? Should we add that?
I mean, whatever Pavlov's dog's name was, I guess.
Yeah, maybe.
There was also a dog that went to space. I don't think we want to talk about that dog, though. That's a sad dog.
We've had enough dog talk. Okay, women in science.
Yeah. But yeah, we wanted to make sure, first of all, that we're not just shouting out white women in science. So I was also specifically looking, you know, we've been pretty hard into the basic science. So I wanted to kind of, you know, go a little more into maybe Amanda's area. And so we came up, Mamie Phipps Clark is a social psychologist. She's known for the famous doll experiment. And she studied the impact of racial segregation on preschool children and did vital research for the trial of Brown versus Board of Education that established that racial segregation in schools was unconstitutional. She was also the first Black woman to receive a degree from Columbia University. So yeah, Mamie Phipps Clark seems very cool. And I was looking up this like doll experiment. First of all, are you familiar with this at all as a psychologist yourself?
Yeah, well, this is like the racial doll preference experiment. Yeah. Yes. So I am familiar with it, but please do talk about it because you would have researched it more recently.
Yeah, so it was looking at, it was part of her master's thesis and work on self-identification in nursery school children, basically looking at, she opted not to publish her thesis because she thought it was exploitative to publish with a professor. Apparently there's some whole, like many issues still going on, similar to stuff we've talked about before. Basically, there were four dolls identical in all ways except color, children aged 3 to 7. And then they asked questions to identify racial perception and preference. Show me the doll that you like best or that you'd like to play with. Show me the doll that's the nice doll. Show me the doll that looks bad. Give me the doll that looks like a white child. Give me the doll that looks like you. And so the experiment revealed a preference for the white doll for all the questions and your attributed positive attributes to the white dolls, concluding that prejudice and discrimination and segregation caused Black children to develop a sense of inferiority and self-hatred. So the fact that this preference was seen in Black children as well as in white children, and concluded that if society says it is better to be white, not only white people, but also Black people come to believe it, a child may try to escape the trap of inferiority by denying the fact of his own race, and basically led to kind of further experiments that they repeated in hundreds of children, because again, replication.
They replicated
the name of the game from different parts of this country, where schools were segregated, and they found the same results. They also looked at giving like an outline of a doll color that children could color in themselves. And many of the Black children still colored in the doll, like kind of white and yellow. And basically, yeah, a lot of conclusions around demonstrating that segregation in school affected children negatively. And yeah, it was very interesting and was very foundational for kind of the eventual legal work that resulted in segregation being found to be unconstitutional.
Yeah.
So I thought she was very cool. Received a humanitarianism award for her work from the National Coalition of 100 Black Women. And yeah, seems like a pretty cool lady. So I was very excited to learn more about her when I was like, I bet you there are some cool people that I don't know about that I want to find out about. So that was the name of the game here.
Yeah. Great. Well, awesome. Thanks so much, Melissa. I love that we are doing that segment and that we're highlighting all of these kind of broader issues for careers in science and women in those careers. So great. Where can people keep up with you, a woman in science and in podcasting? What else are you have going on, Melissa?
Yeah, fair enough. So first of all, keep sending us your ideas for women in STEM. Also, you know, gladly take your I will very happily broaden this category to people who are marginalized by gender in science, if we want to shout out some, you know, non-binary and trans scientists, also could be very cool. So keep the recommendations coming. I know we've got a couple already that we'll be shouting out in the upcoming podcast, but more are always welcome. And otherwise, you can find me, MelissaW28 on Twitter, MelissaWoodward28 on other social media. I am currently podcasting about Goosebumps, which is a really great time, podcasting about Doctor Who, which has been really fun. I was on the Wheel of Time wrap-up. I was also on One Describable Podcast. They're covering Girls 5 Eva right now, and so we talked about the second episode of that. Very silly show. Otherwise, one of the things that I'm most excited to shout out, Rich and I are talking Dimension 20 right now. So if you're at all into Dungeons and Dragons or just like comedy improv, because it's all of the like college humor cast. So a lot of very recognizable faces from those videos. We are talking about that and their season currently happening called Burrow's End. And I think we're starting to kind of uncover some of the mystery. So I'm very excited to talk to Rich this week about that. And yeah, I think that's it. There's it feels like there's a lot going on, but I have like gone through my mess of craziness and come out the other side to just get to do fun podcasts like this. So yeah, what about you, Amanda?
Awesome. Well, you can keep up with everything I'm doing on Twitter, where I'm at Dr. Amanda R. That's D-R, Amanda R. And I am bringing weekly coverage of the entertainment strike still ongoing in Hollywood. SAG-AFTRA is still on strike. Actually, on the eve of this podcast recording, they are set to resume negotiations on Tuesday. But I just published a great interview with Molly Schock, who is a Emmy-nominated reality TV editor, and got her perspective on the world of unscripted television. Really, really interesting conversation there. I have some more great podcast lined up for you on Strike Up the Conversation, where I am also giving updates on the status of the negotiations with the AMPTP. And that's all I have going on right now, but do stay posted because there's a couple other things in the works.
Yay.
Yeah. And of course, more lessons in chemistry. We're going to be bringing you more weekly coverage throughout this series. So keep stay tuned, so subscribe, and you won't miss anything that we're doing. Take care. Bye-bye.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.